defender. He's well struck from distance. It's another glorious goal. Montes just waiting on the edge of the area, and he's waiting for something like that to fall to him.
Dami Diaz. It's Dami Diaz. It's a cracker. The captain rolls back for years. No, he's got that in the locker. He has got that in the locker.
Experience and youth combined. And for Palmeiras, that could be devastating in this year's CONMEBOL Libertadores.
All right. Hello, welcome along to Wilson and Windsor's Libertadores podcast. One of the very few podcasts in English talking about the greatest club competition in South America, the Copa Libertadores.
Might as well go. If you want to have that as the intro, we can go. Yeah, I mean, not? Perfect level.
That was a little peek behind the scenes there. That's probably as much research and prep goes into these polls, but there we go. Let's start on a positive note, Mr. Ollie Wilson, because you're a positive person, I'm a positive person. There's a positive world out there, even though it's a pretty grey day in Buenos Aires.
Can we just say that winter has hit the country? Like, winter is here. I'm very positive about it because I like a bit of grey. You know, this sunshine, it's not really my bag. Too much vitamin D, I think you can have definitely. So, yeah, but winter has struck. I mean, it's cold now in South America, which is, I think, it's going to be good for football.
I also think that there's a myth just outside football a bit of a macro. You say Argentina, people assume that's a sunny country for 12 mm-hmm. months of the year. There's a 6 month winter here, or 5 or 6 month winter. And by the way, I like it. I like the seasons. Like next week's all, you know, blue skies and sunshine and stuff. But the temperature comes right down. And you only really get like a 4 month proper summer.
I think like maybe some people might think, you know, if you go north, because it's a journey north and then some, you know, you travel 15, 16 hours on a bus north, you're still not out of the country yet. It's a big old long country. So you could probably have a much warmer climate up in the north of the country once you get to the border of, say, Brazil, somewhere like that. That's where you probably get a bit more, oh yeah, you can go down to Argentina in like their winter and it's still really nice. But you go much further than Buenos Aires as well and you go down to Patagonia, like the winter's longer than 6 months. I mean, you got glaciers down there. We're getting down towards the kind of Arctic Circle kind of thing. I mean, Antarctica. It's got a bit of everything in terms of its geographical kind of setup. And it's definitely a chilly winter down here.
Yeah, one of the things that makes this country so great, I think, about is just the vastness of the fact that you've got mountains and deserts and glaciers and, like, you know, open plains and all the rest of it. But anyway, two Brits complaining about the weather. Let's talk about the Copa Libertadores, Ollie. One great thing after match day four in the Copa Libertadores is that so many of these groups are really tight. And I made a point a couple of pods ago about how sometimes match day six is a bit of a dead rubber in so many groups. But I actually think this time around, this year, because the groups are really, really tight, match day five and match day six are going to be exceptional. I think they're going to be the best two match days of the group. And one reason why these groups are still so tight is because the Brazilian sides only get going on about match day three or four. And I think a lot of them, if I'm not mistaken, Fluminense and certainly Flamengo, have their last two games at home in the Libertadores. And I think the knowledge that they have that, those last two games, match day five and six, at home, on their own patch, I just think it makes them so casual in the first few match days. We could talk about Flamengo losing this week, but I think that the sloppiness of the Brazilians has caused, in some ways, a knock-on effect of these groups being so tight until the end, which is fantastic for the competition.
I do think, just the point of two straight home games to finish, some sides have got two straight away games, therefore, to finish. I see that as a really kind of detrimental fact to the competition. Now, I haven't looked into how you could rejig it so that that isn't the case, that you don't get two home games or two away games for your last two games. Because anybody in a reasonably tight group, you could only have like 4 points from your first four games at this point. If you know you've got two home games and the importance of home field advantage that we've discussed about at great lengths on this competition, particularly if you're a side that play at altitude, etc., coming away with 10 points should get you through into the knockout stages and get you at least second place in the group, without a doubt. And it allows teams to be more casual, which I don't think provides great football for at least half of the group stage. I don't think it provides a great attitude for teams, knowing that you have, say, a great powerhouse of a squad behind you and you've got two home games going into the group stage to finish it off. So while the groups are tight and that's awesome, there could still be a kind of a great gulf, say, between Fluminense and anybody else in that group. If they come away with another two wins, walk away with 14 points, nobody's getting close to 14 points in Group A if they do that, and they'll win that group at a canter. Now, the argument is they've had their away games already. They've done enough to just grind through, pick up enough points to have 8 points from four games, and credit to that. But I just think it takes some of the jeopardy a little out of it, and particularly if you're a Brazilian side with the strength that they have in their league and the financial disparity they have to everybody else, you kind of look at it and think, well, yeah, Fluminense are going to win two on a home soil, so they're through. Who's chasing for second still?
Yeah, I think... look, I disagree in the sense that I think that you're talking very much about like marginal gains here or there, whereas I think the reality is there's four sides in a group, two go through, you play everyone twice. I don't know. I don't think it's a massive deal if you're two games at home at the end. But let's talk about the big boys from Brazil, Ollie, because this is where this all ties in. Flamengo. We saw it in last year's competition. It's still an immensely talented squad, but there's still just this very odd, sluggish, arrogant air to them that we're Flamengo, you know, we won two of the last 4 or 5 years or whatever, and we're going to be fine again. They weren't fine last year, got knocked out by, was it Cerro Porteño, and really kind of casually knocked out as well. And when you look at Group E, Flamengo, the you know, one of the biggest clubs on the continent, they got 4 points on the board after four games. They scored four goals. So it is a bit arrogant suggesting that they can just go into those final two games at the Maracanã, win both of them, be fine. They probably will be. But it's absolutely not guaranteed. So just starting on the big boys from Brazil. And Flamengo and Palmeiras, Oli, are two sides that we always kind of look in parallel with each other, don't we? Because they won four of the last 5 years between them. But this year, Palmeiras look pretty sharp and Flamengo look pretty dodgy.
Well, Palmeiras finally look pretty sharp. I mean, they weren't great on match day three. They've come away from match day four with a big 5-0 victory over Liverpool, avenging the problematic game that they had against Liverpool last time out. Palmeiras have taken a while to get going. They almost lost to Independiente del Valle, then dragged themselves back in the second half. This is more like the, okay, we're taking the competition seriously now. This is the first time that you've looked at Palmeiras and gone, that is a marker suddenly being set down. And I'm pretty sure if you go back over the group stage discussions, there's always one of these Brazilian sides that suddenly, on match day four or match day five, lays down one of these big markers of, we're taking it seriously, and Palmeiras have done that. It doesn't necessarily surprise me. It's a wide open group behind them, Palmeiras. You know, they're going to be through. It doesn't really matter too much. An impressive win, but over arguably the weakest side in the group. I don't find football interesting when the side that should win wins. And Palmeiras should win, and they should win big. And that's kind of what's happened on match day four.
Let's talk about Fluminense and then the defending champions. I mean, I think that they're top of the group, top of Group A. They've got 8 points from four games. They've only conceded two goals. I want to talk about John Kennedy in a minute, but I just want to say that it's not guaranteed at all that they're through, because that group's still pretty tight. They're home against Cerro Porteño and they're home against Alianza Lima in the last two games. Look, Alianza Lima, they're not very good. So they could easily, they'll be looking at that at the banker. But Cerro Porteño aren't a bad side. And they go there, you know, to the Maracanã. Maybe they win, Colo-Colo win the other game. I don't think that's a done deal just yet.
I look at the group, though, for the number of goals scored in that group. It's almost pathetic after four games.
Ten goals total scored.
Yeah, Fluminense have four of them. The other sides have only scored two each. And the fact Fluminense have played one game at home, the rest have been on the road, you look at that and you think, at home, Fluminense, with the squad they have, with the quality they have, should be able to find some scoring form. Whereas others who have had their home games already, like a Colo-Colo, haven't been able to convert chances in the place that they're meant to feel most comfortable. Now they have pressure on and have to go away. So when I was looking at this group after, well, going in, because I did the Fluminense game this week, but in the fallout of it as well, I was thinking, they're not through, but I'd really struggle to find any side that's going to put up a big enough fight to knock off Fluminense off that perch, a top spot in the group at this point. Really interesting for them going forward. There's a few things that have happened, obviously, with Thiago Silva coming back. My co-commentator, Beira Brazil, was smart in kind of mentioning that they can move to this back three, which opens up the fullbacks a lot more, Marquinhos and Marcelo, to push on, which they love pushing forward anyway.
Worth just sitting on that, Ollie, just a moment. So Thiago Silva obviously leaving Chelsea in the summer straight into this Fluminense side, presumably, and he's going to come, you know, in time for the knockout stages. And that feels like, you know, Thiago Silva, I know, he's 40 now, 39, 40, something like that.
What's age on this continent?
For sure. For Chelsea, that's you're getting on a bit. Although you speak to a lot of Chelsea fans, and loads of them really like him. I mean, Rolls Royce of a centre-back. I think he comes into this Fluminense side, and it's one of those signings in between the group stages and the knockout games that you think, wow, yeah, that's a signing that you know makes a big difference.
Yeah, I don't want to mess around with the back three of Felipe Melo, Thiago Silva, and Manuel, even if their cumulative age adds up to about 130 in total, because they're all over 40 now, I think, in that back three.
Chucking Fabio, the goalkeeper, and yeah.
Yeah, and you're really cracking on to almost 150 at that point, way past it, in fact. So it's not going to have legs, but in a back three, you don't necessarily have to have legs because all three of you know you're sitting deep. It's not like one's being a ball-playing centre-back pushing forward, and none of those three are going to be that. Felipe Melo's going to be the guy that gets yellow-carded and almost talks his way into a red. Manuel's going to be the guy that clears up the pieces around Felipe Melo quite adeptly without really getting the same shining light on him as some of the others in that side. And Thiago Silva's going to come in and steal Felipe Melo's thunder and be an experienced centre-back who has that bit of quality on the ball to be able to play that sweeper role in the centre and play it out from the back up to the midfield and up to the wide players, who they have a litany of quality wide players in that Fluminense side.
I think if you combine Thiago Silva with the fact that John Kennedy, who scored the winner in the Libertadores final at the back end of last year, I mean, what can you say? I don't know the ins and outs, but by all accounts, he's just a party boy and not that interested in football. And this is certainly the club side of the story. There's always two sides, by the way. But obviously, he's been a bit of a bad boy, a bit naughty. But Fluminense now, apparently this week, they said, look, he's going to come back. I think maybe he's going to play this weekend in the league, or well, certainly he'll be a part of the Libertadores squad next week. I just think those two players coming back in, because John Kennedy is electric. Like, he's a super exciting player, especially when he's alongside Herman Cano, who, you know, not that exciting. He's just more of a poacher, isn't he? So he needs someone like John Kennedy sort of buzzing around. And I don't think Fluminense are going to... I don't think they're going to get back-to-back Libertadores titles. But the fact that Thiago Silva's come into the club and the fact that John Kennedy, if they can successfully integrate him back in, that is a big mark on that. Okay, you know, maybe they're not far off Palmeiras. They're not far off Atlético Mineiro in the sharp end of the tournament.
No. Even without Kennedy, though, I'd say they have the quality in that Marquinhos and Douglas Costa are 1A and 1B at this point. Douglas Costa, with more experience, did pick up an injury this week in the Libertadores, so be interesting to see the fallout of that. But to be honest, Marcelo doesn't need to do too much on that left flank. And if they do switch in the knockout stages to a back three and only have wing backs, like, Kennedy can maybe shift in down the middle, but they've got more than enough quality with that. Ganso as well, just playing off with the number 10. And they've got a huge amount of talent coming off the bench, as we saw in midweek against Colo-Colo, that was able to kind of do the same thing that they did. The thing for me with Fluminense is their style this year, and they did it superbly, and I hate it when teams play like this because you're playing with fire. It was the old boxing analogy of rope-a-dope. You sit in, you tuck in, you make life difficult, you let the opposition wear themselves down, and then you hit late when your moment comes. It's exactly what they did, scoring, 15 minutes to go, with a slightly fortuitous goal when Marcelo hits a pretty tame effort from distance and Manuel gets a flick on it and nods it past the keeper. But that was pretty much the only attacking period that Fluminense had in the game, aside from one effort, I think, beaten away by the Colo-Colo keeper, Cortez, in the latter part of the first half. You can't do that, I don't think, in knockout football, because there's too strong a likelihood of making a mistake if you're allowing everybody to sit in, sit back, and try and soak up pressure and play perfectly defensively. But at the moment, they're kind of doing what Diniz wants them to do. It seems like the style of football they want to play to get through this group stage and to grind it out. And it'll be interesting to see, actually, on home soil, with the group pretty much done for them, yeah, They'll be in the top two, if they do become a bit more expressive, or if we see that in the early part of the knockout stages as well.
But I feel I like you're more challenge. Bullish on Fluminense, Oli, having watched them and done the game on match day 4.
I've just got a belief in a side that has talent, in a side that has a manager who has a clear style of football that he wants to play, whether you like it or not. Anybody that has a clear set way of playing the football that they want to play for a team that knows how to play it, I think has got a chance at this level of competition with the quality they have. And they're adding to it if they bring back Kennedy, with Thiago Silva coming back in into the fold. It's they can't not be a contender.
Don't let's finish the week without talking about Roque Santa Cruz scoring as well, Ollie. It just popped into my head, which we don't have on the list. Well, let's do it now, because he did score, second oldest goal scorer in Libertadores history at 42 and something days. The oldest was Zé Roberto for Palmeiras back in 2017. And if Libertad can find a way to qualify, which I don't think they will, then he'll have a shot in the last 16 of being the oldest goal scorer in Libertadores history. A few days shy of his 43rd birthday, which, you know, we're getting silly with the ages here. I just want to wrap up on the Brazilian side. Fluminense, we think, you know, pretty much as good as through. Sao Paulo have already qualified. Wanted to just have a word on Grêmio, Ollie, because I think this is something, it's one of those massive news stories that should be way bigger and isn't because it hasn't affected a quote-unquote Western country, a US, a Europe or Australia. The fact that Porto Alegre, the city of Porto Alegre, and indeed the entire state of Rio Grande do Sul is basically underwater because of flooding. Hundreds of people have lost their lives. Loads of others are missing. People's lives are like destroyed and they'll have to rebuild their lives from scratch. It's a massive international news story that just hasn't got any traction. Not okay, it's got some traction, but you know what I mean? Certainly in the UK media, like barely BBC did an article about it 3 or 4 days after it happened. And how this relates to it in a football context, by the way, is Grêmio's game on match day 4 was postponed. Their game on match day 5 is going to be postponed. We're wondering where they're going to fit in these matches. But
so the game coming up this week is now, I thought initially it said it was going to be moved to this coming Sunday. We're recording on Sunday, so a week's time. It's not. It's actually going to be in June that they're going to play that. The 4th of June, I think it is.
Before the Copa America, okay.
So they're going to get, but that's match day 5. There's still a match day 4 unplayed game lingering in the background that they need to get in somewhere, somehow. How that works, we don't know yet.
Yeah, that's the kind of football element. Also affects Internacional, doesn't it, who are in the Sudamericana. But just pretty shocking. I mean, we don't want to talk too much outside sort of football and stuff, Ollie, but just a crazy situation, really, something like that, which you feel when you're down here because people talk about it and you see the pictures a bit more. I think the algo kind of reverts to South American news stories a bit more. So, yeah, just crazy, really.
It's a tragedy. It's a genuine tragedy. There are hundreds of people lost their lives, thousands displaced, lost their homes, businesses. And it's flooding like I've never seen it. The only thing I can think of that recall from when I was a youngster, remember the terrible floods in like Bangladesh,
yeah,
when we were very young. It has a similar feeling, except it's in a like more developed nation, so it almost feels more shocking because you would have thought there would be safeguards against
the,
it.
The richest part of Brazil as well, Ollie.
And it's they're using tanks and boats down the river, down the streets to save horses from drowning and stuff. I mean, it's not like small potatoes. We're talking up to the second story of houses here. The whole stadiums, the Arena do Grêmio and Internacional's Arena are both totally flooded. Obviously not up to the roof, but I mean, completely unplayable. They can't even get planes off the airport, can't get planes in. It's a nightmarish situation. You hope it can be resolved as quickly as possible.
Right. I want to segue now. I echo those thoughts 100%. I want to echo now. Yeah,
good luck segueing.
I want to segue now, sorry, onto something I really love in football. It doesn't happen very often, Ollie, but when it does, it's beautiful. It's when Group D is the group of death. And we have Group D this year that has become the group of death between Junior, Botafogo, Universitario and Liga de Quito. 2 points separating 4 teams. Been some really watchable games in this group as well, because 4 like pretty big football clubs, like Liga de Quito won it before, Junior, a big club from Colombia, and Botafogo got the Brazilian money, don't they? Led the Brazilian league for so long last year. So yeah, really interesting. You've got the group of death in Group D.
2 games at home for Liga de Quito up in Quito as well to finish off the group. Yep. That's a lovely one to have in the back pocket. Yep. For the reigning Sudamericana champions. Junior,
and they're bottom of the group as well, Liga de Quito at the moment. I know I just said it's tight, but
it's 2 points, yeah, separating them and the top two, Botafogo and Junior. And Junior are a side that we first came here in 2019, and we were told a lot about this Junior team, that, you know, is one of the best sides in Colombia, and it's going to be great to see them, and they should be able to compete at this sort of level quite easily. And I don't think I've ever seen a Junior side reach any sort of element where I've thought, oh, they could be a rank outsider, a bit like a Liga de Quito or an Independiente del Valle or someone like that. So the fact that Junior now, top of the group, kind of got it in their own hands at least for the last 2 games. Botafogo, surprising that they're struggling, just because the expectation on the Brazilian side.
Last 2 games away as well for Botafogo.
And great to have a Peruvian side in Universitario, like up there, just a point off the top of the group, point off the top two, because the Peruvians don't fare well in this competition 99 times out of 10. And it's a great ground that they've got. It's this big
99 times out of 10, by the way, right?
Sorry, yeah.
No, times out of 100. The Peruvian sides are that bad that yeah, even though the statistic doesn't make sense. Like, didn't Alianz Lima go like 3,000 matches without a win in the Libertadores or something?
Still going, isn't it? I think, yeah.
Maybe.
But I think they lost like 23 in a row in the Libertadores as well, Alianza Lima. It's not strong. But they've got some great stadiums, as I say, the Universitario Stadium. That was the one that hosted
2019
final. And when it gets rocking, I mean, I've been lucky enough back in the day doing some of the Peruvian league football back in our old Bet365 days. I did the derby of Universitario and... I can't remember who the other side is. Derby. I mean, it shows how long ago it was. But it was nuts that you're like, how? I've never really seen this sort of football before when you're covering it. And then it's like, this is mental. This is the kind of atmosphere that draws you in and gets you sucked into a bit of South American football and the atmosphere and everything that goes on around the football, which is sometimes a bit lacking. So it'd be great to see them in a knockout stage. That would be the kind of place that produces the Cerro Porteño 2019 fireworks, intimidating atmosphere.
Definitely. And I think you're right to point out the crowds, because I love a Peruvian ground. It's obviously colder up there as well. So like everyone in the ground sort of huddled in, and it just looks nice in the hour before kickoff when I'm looking at all the pictures. Just looks like quite a fat... It could be completely wrong. It's bloodthirsty outside the ground, but it just looks quite family-friendly, a little Fulham, you know, Fulham away trip. Like
it's like the Bolivian sides. You tend to get just like pockets of maybe 20 people in a group together on these big stands. They don't necessarily fill out a lot of the arenas, the Bolivian supporters, particularly in the group stages. So there's just like 20-odd there, 20-odd there, 20-odd there. There's a couple of kids just on the phone during half-time.
Midnight.
Yeah, yeah. You know, like you do, you bring the kids out, you watch a game. Look, we've all been there as youngsters, taken to the football by our dads or whatever, or mums, and you end up getting home nice and late. It's, you know.
Absolutely. Group F, Ollie, and like, look, it's so disappointing when you really, really look forward to watching a side play and commentate on a side, and they kind of disappoint. I was really looking forward to IDV going to San Lorenzo Independiente of the Del Valle. You know, Ollie and I are very neutral, but we do have a particular bias when it comes to IDV just because they're a sort of fantastic football club.
Yeah, I'm 100% non-neutral. Yeah, I'm 100% not neutral.
They reached the Libertadores final back in 2016, won a couple of Sudamericanas in recent years. I mean, massively punch above their weight in terms of how big they are as a kind of as a place. But they went to San Lorenzo in absolutely dire form across all competitions, and they got beaten 2-0. San Lorenzo were quite good, took their chances, kind of fed off the energy of the crowd, and IDV just never settled. I mean, we talked about Kendry Pice. I think one of the things with young players is that sometimes the atmosphere in the game can kind of get away from them, and that's when they need like older heads just to steady the ship a little bit, put 15 passes together and just settle. And IDV just didn't have that. They needed the Pejorano of way back when to calm things down. Never had that, never settled into any kind of rhythm. The good news is for IDV is that this group, Palmeiras, obviously 10 points and all but mathematically qualified Palmeiras from 10 points. The other three sides are on 4 points. And IDV, they got to go to Palmeiras and got to go to Brazil. It's not impossible. It's a bit of a free hit. They could actually lose that game and still, if they win on match day 6, beat Liverpool and win the group, they need a couple of other things to go for them. But, IDV disappointing. San Lorenzo, despite being pretty crap, are suddenly like in contention. And, you know, those three sides have got 4 points. Who do you fancy out of those three sides?
They've never been a good side to watch since we've been covering this, have they, San Lorenzo? There's not a single time that I've got into a San Lorenzo game and thought, oh, yes. The first year it was all Colaccini's at the back. But aside from that, there's been very little of... And that game against Independiente Del Valle was San Lorenzo doing what they do well, really boring, bland, dry football, and imposing it at will on an opposition of maybe slightly too naive aside to be able to deal with that sort of grinding out a victory. They took their chances. Independiente Del Valle, as you say, never got going. Never found those balls into the channels that we were touching on last time out. To go through? I mean, I'm going to back IDV because that's what I want at the end of the day as well. They're still the best footballing side that I've watched of 90 minutes in this competition. It's not a discredit to Palmeiras, who I think probably play the best football overall in the Copa Libertadores this year right now. But IDV would be the one that I want to go through. And at this point, there's no point going with anything but my heart. So I'll take IDV.
Love it. Great life advice for everyone out there in the Wilson and Windsor Libertadores podcast. It'd be nice to see a couple of Uruguayan sides go through, Ollie. And it's not impossible either because Peñarol have always disappointed, haven't they, following this competition. They're disappointed because the expectation is unrealistic because they won the Libertadores 5 times. But in reality, this is all back in the 60s. And I think last time they won, it was like late 80s, which is... you know, since we were born in the late 80s. This is quite a while ago now. So it's unfair, I think, to expect anything from Peñarol. But you kind of do, because the atmosphere is always cracking at home and their name is still Peñarol, and you kind of think things are going to happen. And in Group G, they do have 6 points from 4 games. They are second place in the group. Atlético Mineiro, you know, possibly the most informed side in the competition with 4 wins from 4 at top of the group. But I think Peñarol can go through there, because Caracas aren't very good at all. And I think Peñarol are better than Rosario Central. So, yeah, I don't know. It'd be nice to see, you know, if Liverpool maybe could squeeze through in the Palmeiras and IDV group and, you know, Peñarol got through. It'd be nice to see a couple of Uruguayan sides.
Yeah, Argentina have got enough sides going through. So we don't necessarily need to have Rosario getting there as well. You know, Tejera is probably the best playing side out of the Argentinians in this competition. River will end up going through, obviously. So let's get the big Uruguayan side in. I'm not too fussed about Nacional. I'd rather see like a Libertad go through instead, for various reasons. But Atletico Mineiro, probably one of the other sides in this competition that over the long game. Fluminense, Palmeiras and them are probably the three strongest overall of what you'd look at in the knockout stages. And they've been pretty good in the group, just grinding out results quite functionally, which is all you want at this stage. Peñarol, and you never trust. That's the trouble, is that they do actually have flashes of playing some really good football. And they had a Herculean effort against Atlético Mineiro to get themselves back into that game when they were 3-0 down. And you were genuinely worried for the Brazilians on home soil that they were going to let that one slip through their fingers on match day two. The difference is it's easy to rally yourself up for a kind of free hit to go for broke against a Brazilian side when you're 3-0 down at halftime. You need to grind out victories in the last couple of games, though, to make sure that you get the results to get through. I reckon they've got enough. I haven't seen enough from Rosario. They've got a good head on them, Rosario. They can stand a couple of rocks thrown at them, so that's strong. But, you know,
I think just the fact Peñarol have a couple of home games in the last 2 games, maybe they'll be all right. I want to just talk about Hulk quickly, Ollie. What does he do in training? Because my feeling is he picks up the ball on the halfway line in training, rolls it 5 yards in front of him and just shoots, because that's what he does in the games. And the problem for me is people only see the clips of him on like Twitter or something, and they'll think, oh, look, Hulk's still banging them in from 40 yards. It's like, well, yeah.
Yeah, if you throw enough at a wall, something exactly will stick.
It's,
yeah,
it's the broken clock. And I like Hulk. I think he's fun to watch. I still think he's got a lot to offer. I mean, look, he starts for Atlético Mineiro side that Bar Palmeiras, probably the second favourites to win it. And he's still got a lot to offer, but I mean, I just have never seen a footballer so consistently shoot from so far out. Like, it's silly. Like a free kick anywhere within 40 yards,
yeah,
he's shooting.
Yeah, and it was great in that game against Peñarol when Hulk had had 2 or 3 that were an absolute disaster, and then Gaston Ramirez steps up and hits one in the second half and strikes the frame of the goal, and that's the deciding moment really in the game, because that would have made it 3-3, and suddenly Mineiro are on their heels and looking down at the barrel of the Uruguayans are in full flow. Hulk is actually great though in this Atletico Mineiro side, because he shoots a lot from distance when it comes to a set piece. In the actual game though, he does bring a lot of players into it. He's a really good hold-up player, because he's got that physical frame, he always has. I mean, it's great that he's Hulk and he's fucking massive. Like,
clues in the title.
No coincidence.
Clues in the
yeah
title.
So I do think he does a lot of good for them. And he's the kind of great player to have if you've got a nippy little forward or creative player, like a Zaracho alongside him, for Hulk to be able to, right, I'll hold up, draw two defenders in, because it's going to take, I've still got the skill to go one-on-one, so I'm going to bring two in, and that gives you that extra bit of space elsewhere. So you have to start bringing men even deeper to deal with Hulk and support when you've got runners off like Paulinho, like Zaracho, and Gustavo Scarpa as well, of course, who's, you know, been in great form in this competition so far. So he's actually, you could make the joke, but I'm going to bring it down, Windsor, and say he's actually the linchpin, really, in this Atletico Mineiro side.
No, love it, man. I also love the fact that it's normalised that he gets to be called for his entire footballing career Hulk. Yeah. Like, it's absolutely absurd that people have just gone along with that.
Yeah, it's fine.
Like, just because he's got big shoulders and he's not a bodybuilder. Like, he's just a bigger lad. Like, I'm just trying to think of someone in European football.
Why could Akinfenwa not get away with being Beast and literally
we
calling
beast
him
on
Beast
back
on commentary. Yeah.
Commentator screams Beast. Well, you know, I don't know.
He's Hulk. Bigger. Akinfenwa again is bigger than
big
Hulk
boy
and deserves the moniker more, but first come, first serve.
Yeah, I do agree with you. With the way Hulk holds it up is still fantastic to watch and bring others into play. And not many strikers can do that in the Libertadores. I don't think you don't have that same thing, not to harp on about IDV too much. And I don't think Hoyos is a bad player. He's the main striker for IDV these days. But if they just had someone a little bit stronger that could bring everyone in a little bit more against San Lorenzo, they're really missing that kind of that figure that could hold it up well. So, yeah, 100% Hulk. Group H, Ollie. We're going to talk about River, I think, a little bit separately because Ollie and I went to the Monumental yesterday and saw River play, and it was quite an experience, which we can chat about. Look, River, top of the group, 10 points. All but mathematically, you know, they're through. They're the side, really, aren't they, outside the big boys from Brazil that could win this competition?
No.
So outside the Brazilian side, who can do it then?
I don't think anybody can. If River's the only hope we've got, I don't think there's going to be one. I mean, you're quite hot on Bolivar, and the difficulty of going to take on Bolivar might actually be a huge tool to have going through the knockout stages. If they can get results on home soil and big results on home soil, then that could play really well into their hands. And they have been impressive in Group E so far. If Flamengo do flounder in those last two games and suddenly it's Bolivar and Palestino and you've knocked out one of the big tournament favourites suddenly at the group stage, again, that's a good feather in the cap to have. It's a real confidence booster. And if they win that group, who knows what could happen.
They're decent. They're really decent, Bolivar. And I think, I think they're decent. I mean, 10 points from four games and... I think the thing is, if they got a Palmeiras in the last 16, I don't think they're going through. They'd have to avoid... you could say this about anyone, maybe. But I think they'd have to avoid Palmeiras and Atlético Mineiro.
But when I look at a River Plate and I compare that, like, their worst nightmare is taking on a Fluminense side that are playing the way they're playing at the moment, because I don't think River Plate can break down that Fluminense side. And if they do, they get limited to efforts from distance or from awkward angles and they don't find a way through, because I don't think someone like Miguel Borja on his own is good enough to be able to break down a defence and has the tools around him to be able to do that. I mean, from what I've seen in the Libertadores this year and what we saw on the weekend this weekend, it's such a far cry from great River sides, and the Brazilian sides have taken such a big step further on from that. Even I would argue, you know, Boca of last year would have a better chance than this River side because of the way that Boca play. Of they have that, or they used to, they're actually playing some great football this year, but the old idea under Almirón of that Atletico Madrid style of football: defend first, one goal, maybe two needed if you need it, particularly in knockout stage football. This would be great for Boca this year's tournament, considering how we've seen the Brazilian sides play so far. Obviously, it could change as we go through the knockout stages.
Yeah, well, we'll talk about River separately maybe tomorrow. But yeah, I mean, it is a shame, just in a Libertadores context. I mean, that River side in 2019, the attacking options they had in Scocco and Prato and Matias Suarez and Borre. I mean, they had four, like, pretty decent strikers. Mm-hmm. And now, like, Borja obviously was great, but he's kind of not really the same. Nacho Fernandez is not as good as he was previously. Everyone who's still there is a bit older than they were. It's a shame, like...
The Borja arrival does scream of, like, when... We touched on it a little bit on the way to the ground yesterday of, like, it's difficult when you've had an iconic manager to bring somebody else in to achieve the same. And the Borja signing is the same kind of signing that this current post-Ferguson Manchester United era would make of, oh, yeah, he's good, we'll just get him in. Yeah, that'll give us a focal point. And, like, you know, signing a Cavani, for instance, United or somebody like that when they did. It's not what you need, but it looks good to sign him, and it will appease the fans because it'll be someone they know, as opposed to you maybe going with one of the youngsters or something like that. It'll be interesting. Obviously, they've got Libertad coming up, and Libertad third place in this group. They also play Nacional at home in the last game of the group stage, which that's really tasty.
Libertad needs something, I think, against the Monumental, because if you look at the other game in the group, even if Libertad win on the final day, I think Libertad are going to need to get a point at the Monumental to qualify.
I wouldn't be afraid of taking a point at the Monumental either if I'm Libertad. You don't have to play for much. If you can be solid defensively and maybe not sit too deep and be too fearful, there's a good chance of them coming away with something. You know, there's some old heads in there that can kind of guide them through. So
I'm just dying for Libertad to get through so Roque Santa Cruz can have a bash. Because I think if someone scores and they're 43, because I think he turns 43 in August, if someone can... not even score. If you can have a 43-year-old who's just playing in the knockout stages of the Libertadores at 43.
Well, would he become, if he ends, I mean, he'll probably finish third if he doesn't obviously make the top two. the oldest scorer in CONMEBOL competitions.
Oh, interesting. You mean if they drop down
to the Sudamericana? Because they'll go to the Sudamericana, obviously.
Don't know about that.
Because that would be one you can still keep an eye on. I mean, if he hits 42 and a half, 43 during the Sudamericana this year and ends up bagging a goal at some point, which he probably will, there still might be a record for him to hang his hat on. You'll have a Sudamericana this year that will have Gonzalo Mastroianni of Atletico Paranaense becoming the all-time leading scorer. He's only two goals off levelling that.
Oh, that's nice.
At the moment, again, behind Barcos, who had 19, I think, to his name. Mastroianni's got 5 in 4 games, and Atletico Paranaense had the tits in that competition, basically. So, not to put it too crudely. And then you'll have two records being broken this year in that competition, and stealing a little bit of Libertadores thunder, maybe.
Yeah, I also just, I can't let this podcast finish up talking about Gabigol briefly, because I think just before I came on the plane, I was like reading a tweet. I was like, oh, Gabigol, drugs ban, interesting. Guess he won't be playing. And then, like, I'm pretty sure
it's out of the system now, boss.
It's just like, there he is. All right, he's playing a match day four then. Right, so I don't know quite what happened between those two events. But Gabigol's back. And the only reason he popped in my head, Ollie, is because he still has the all-time Libertadores goal score record within his grasp if he stays fit and focused and at Flamengo for the next 5 years. That's, you know, there's a lot, there's a lot there.
Real macro.
A lot there. But he's got it, man. He can, you know, if he scores an average of 6 or 7 goals in Libertadores for the next 5 years, he could become the all-time Libertadores goal scorer, which Sudamericana all-time goal scorer, obviously it's a big deal because it's a newer competition doesn't quite have the same weight as a competition that started in 1960. Like, if you can become the all-time Libertadores goal scorer, I think that's worth him staying drug-free.
Is he the Kevin Tomkinson from Mike Bassett, England manager of South American football? Like, he's so talented, but he's got such a wild streak in him that it's going to...
Yeah, there's a few of those, aren't
you'd
there?
Still play him. You'd just still play him. You've got to have him playing. I'm always. Sorry, boss. I've got it. I've got it, boss. Just quickly, as a connoisseur of the Copa Libertadores, we've seen many a different group stage play out, but every single group at this point is close. But as we've touched on, unfortunately, almost on every pod so far this year, the quality, it's not been as good to watch. We've seen more dogs on pitches than ever before this season.
That's in the pros column, though.
I mean, it is a pro, but it doesn't scream the Champions League of South American football. We're focused more
on... Champions League shit in the groups.
Yeah, it's not great. But we're focusing more on, like, big refs than, like, big players, that kind of thing. Would you rather have a group stage with match day 5 and 6 like this, where you're going, well, anybody can get through, or where you're going, there are 6 sides that I can't wait to see go head-to-head in knockout competition?
I think just on the Jack Ref, I wonder if we can...
you want to get it back to that just so
like, if we're calling him Hulk, maybe we could call one ref Beast. Like, he doesn't have, like, a surname. We could just do that. I think, look, the group stages is always... It's always a bit edgy, especially, like, no matter what competition, World Cup groups, you'll see it in the Euros this summer. You'll get really pumped up for a game and it'll end up being, like, a 0-0 or a 1-0, especially the first, like, couple of games of the groups. It's always tight. Obviously, the quality is not the same in South America as it is in Europe. I think when we get to the last 16, I mean, I really enjoyed the knockouts last year. And I think, you know, a Palmeiras against Atletico Mineiro in the last 16 or a Palmeiras against the Peñarol and Peñarol scrape a draw in Brazil and take them back. You know, a Universitario going through something. I think as soon as you get to the last 16, the last 8, competition comes alive. And do I think a Brazilian side is going to win again? Yes, but I still think they might be giving it a good run for the match.